The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 36 from the Blue Cliff Record. Changsha goes picnicking. One day, Changsha went wandering in the mountains. Upon returning, when he got to the gate, the head monk asked, "Where are you coming from, master?" Sha said, "From wandering in the mountains." The head monk asked, "Where did you go?" Sha said, "First I went pursuing the fragrant grasses. Then I returned following the falling flowers." The head monk said, "How very much like the sense of springtime." Sha said, "It even surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses." Shuedo added the remark, "Thanks for your reply." And the verse, "The earth is clear of any dust, whose eyes do not open. First he went following the fragrant grasses, then he returned pursuing the falling flowers. A weary crane alights on a withered tree. A mad monkey cries on the ancient terrace." Here we are, the second day of our Sesshin. Entering deeply into the terrace, the mad monkey cries. This terrain that we are exploring is serious business. This matter of life and death. Of course, there are relative states of ease and calm and difficulty and trouble, and we encounter these. But this is the weather of life. And if we try to control the content of the moment, we can get very frustrated or depressed or anxious. And so as we follow Changsha's footsteps, he went wandering in the mountains and he came back to the temple. So many ways of wandering in these mountains of being human. So many places to get lost. So many wondrous treasures reveal themselves in this great coming and going. And so appreciating Changsha's setting out, his intention to wander in the mountains. And it's almost paradoxical. I wonder if he put it on his Google Calendar, Tuesday afternoon, wander in the mountains. Maybe a good idea for all of us. We put this on our calendar. I'll wander through the darkness of my own mind for 3 days. That sounds like fun. I think I'll have a good time. Uh, uh, We set out. Sometimes we go picnicking in the mountains and the rainstorm comes or the wind. We get lost. Mosquitoes bite us. But yet the beauty of the mountains, the beauty of life calls to us. The fragrant grasses, the fragrance of the Dharma. None of us know what it really is, but sometimes we catch a whiff. Sometimes, like a hunting dog, we're just minding our own business, and all of a sudden we smell something. Something that makes our heart leap. And if we're if we allow ourselves, then we can go dashing into the woods, dashing in pursuit of something of great importance. We don't even know what it is, and maybe we get into the woods and we say, what was I looking for? There was something I was chasing. I can't quite remember what it was. And so what to do when we get lost? What to do when we become disoriented? And this quality of being lost, we might say when we no longer know. The problem with all of this Zen teaching and Buddhist teaching is that we can begin to think that we know something, or we can think that we have to know something. This matter of awakening is not a matter of knowing. Hungjur in the field of boundless emptiness says, non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. Of course, our thinking mind wants to figure it out because this is all it knows how to do. And we should be so grateful to these thinking minds. And yet the currency of the thinking mind is not honored here in this land of awakening, this land of suchness. All of your opinions, even your wonderful Zen opinions, are just opinions. So thinking about the four refuges and thinking about the poop you just took this morning, all the same. Thinking about this world, thinking, thinking, and thinking. Not a problem. Non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. And Hungjur in this passage says, this naturally occurs. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. This is the spirit of wandering. This is Changsha's spirit. Very naturally, mind and dharmas, self and other, emerge and harmonize. But we have to set out. We have to have some intention. And in Changsha's response, says, first I went pursuing the fragrant grasses, then I resumed, returned following the falling flowers. So pursuing and following in the verse, Zhuedo reverses it. Zhuedo says, first he went following the fragrant grasses, then he returned pursuing the falling flowers. So we can say, if it's already here, nothing to pursue. But yet this spirit of heading into it, this spirit of bodhicitta, of wanting something, of honoring some yearning deep in us. This is not a matter of manufacturing the right thing, but a matter of coming back again and again to what is it I really want. What is it in this brief lifetime that is most important? And we get sidetracked again and again and again. But there is a naturalness of this yearning. In some ways, I'm reminded of a friend who said that discipline is the courage to follow what we love. And we are indeed each one of us following something ineffable. The wonderful thing about the scent is that it has no apparent substance. It comes and goes. If you walk in the gardens, the temple gardens at this time of year, you can catch the scent of the katsura trees, almost cinnamon or something like that. But for me, it comes and I turn toward it, and then I can't smell it anymore. If I head right at it and think, how can I smell those katsura trees? I kind of miss it in my effort. But if you walk and allow yourself to walk, allow your feet to do what your feet know how to do, then the katsura trees will come to you and will touch you very naturally. The self and other meet and greet each other and know, oh, you, me, no telling who's who in this land. But the pursuit, but the intention to come to Sesshin, to come to the temple, to come online, in some ways makes no difference, but the habit force is so strong. The opinion of the mind of what Zen is, what I am, what this is about, how it should be, how I should be. This habit force is so strong that without a great intention and a great effort required to allow what is already here to manifest. The great patience of the Dharma, the great patience of thusness, of life itself, waiting for us, available at any moment, no matter how lost or how turned upside down, how discouraged, how dark it is. Still, you have never been separate for an instant. This great Dharma, vast and subtle, here and requiring some pursuit. And what is it we pursue? We're told that we should have a practice and stay with our practice. We are heading into the heartland. We are heading into the mystery. We are heading into the don't know that is so hilarious and such a relief and has this capacity to upend everything we thought and to have us see that all of this trying, so wonderful and touching, and all of the trying so necessary and yet totally unnecessary. This is not about you becoming a good Zen student. In fact, one of the things we must all do is abandon our great Zen plan. Oh, I'm going to do 3 retreats, and by the end of the 3rd retreat, maybe they'll really recognize who I am, and I'll get to do this or that. It's not about getting someone's approval. I had a dream once, and it was before I was going on a retreat with a very well-known and very strict Zen master. And in the retreat, this Zen teacher, who was very sick at the time, was in the hospital, and I went and visited him in the hospital, and he put his hand on my head and gave me his blessing. And I was quite touched by this dream, and I reported it to my teacher, who was quite upset with me. He said, "This is not about getting the Roshi's blessing." He said, "There is something here that is more than that." So we bring our strategies of pleasing people in power and trying to curry favor. But they too, we have to set aside, or there is the opportunity to set aside, or maybe that's makes it sound too conscious, that they can wear away. So all this talk of wandering and hunger, again, in the field of boundless emptiness, he begins saying, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. So this great freedom is what exists from the very beginning. And then he says, you must purify, cure, grind down or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Something is required of you and me, and that something is coming back to the cushion again and again, coming back to the breath again and again. And without this intention and this effort, we will be swept away and carried away by the everydayness and by the 10,000 joys and sorrows. And so we must pursue something, and we must learn to follow. One of the things I so appreciate about retreat, and I always speak of, is the break it gives the part of us that makes decisions. There are not a lot of decisions you need to make on retreat. So we follow the tanto. When the tanto says, time for this, we bow and we head into the zendo. We head to our bunk for a rest. We do what we are told. In this following, there is some kind of freedom. Freed from our own opinion, but I want the rest period to last longer. I want this longer or shorter, or we can notice all of that. And we can practice simply letting it be. You don't have to feel good about coming back to the zendo. You can be incredibly resentful. Well, this is a stupid schedule. I don't know why they don't. You know, and I've had enough of this crazy Zen stuff. And yet we make this vow with each other to show up. This great gift of showing up for ourselves and with ourselves. And we, I think most of us have to remind ourselves that our presence makes a difference. And so we do this practice, we come back to the Zendo, not because we're feeling good or not even because we think there is any hope for us. Maybe we're in this place where I've seen clearly that the matter is hopeless for someone like me. But we come back anyway, and we go into the darkness, into the hopelessness, not as thought, but as the suchness of the moment. And we are the Buddha who sits without hope. This Buddha sits right where they are. In this vow, we can see the coming and going, and we follow the structure of retreat, and we follow the scent of aliveness. What is this in this moment? I think Melissa mentioned yesterday the gift bestowing jewel, and we were talking about how the very places that are most difficult for us and we would most want to escape, the parts of us that are, we might say, broken, or the parts that get in our way again and again and again, and perhaps even the part we came to Zen to get rid of. I'll do Zen and I will not be lonely anymore. I will not have to feel alone. But we begin to see that this very thing at the heart of whatever it is in this moment is life itself. And so even our delusion is not a problem. The delusion, as we were saying yesterday, the delusion, the suffering, is the gift to lead us into life itself. And as we are traveling this road, as we pursue and as we follow, as we learn to follow, quite a discipline of following, because we're so used to planning and making it up in advance. But as we sit in our Zazen, can we really follow the breath? The beginning and the middle and the end, and the breath knows how long or short to be. The breath has been breathing us perfectly since the moment we poked our head into this bright and noisy world. And can we sit and keep our practice simple? We can notice the plans coming up even within the period, the plans for what we'll say in the next doksan, the plans for just simply noticing the plans and coming back and being simple. So important. So as we move deeper into this sesshin, to wander intentionally, heading in the direction of love, heading in the direction of not knowing, heading in the direction of something that has called us, something has called you here, has called you back. What is it? And not what is it in terms of explaining and, oh, it's called this and it's that, but what is the essence of this moment? Study and practice this. Study in the sense of looking into it, investigating life itself, not opinion about life, not philosophy about life, but the aliveness of this moment, whatever it is. And with great courage and determination, and with giving ourself away. Again and again, a thousand plans arise. You can try all your plans. In fact, please, if you have a great strategy, try it. See how it works for you. But eventually, grind down, we purify. We are ground down. We are purified, not pure in the sense of one single thing, but pure in the sense of fully what we are. This practice, fortunately, the Dharma, fortunately, does us. We will be done. You will be fully cooked. You are fully cooked in this moment, cured, hung on the hook in the smoke shack, and we are being cured. So trusting this great, vast, incomprehensible Dharma, and throwing ourselves, as we say, throw yourself into the house of the Buddha. And what house is that? But just here. And just the sound of the traffic and the wind, just sensations in the body. Just this moment. One day, Changsha went wandering in the mountains. Upon returning, when he got to the gate, the head monk asked, "Where are you coming from, master?" Sha said, "From wandering in the mountains." The head monk asked, "Where did you go?" Sha said, "First, I went pursuing the fragrant grasses. Then I returned following the falling flowers." The head monk said, "How very much like the sense of springtime." Sha said, "It even surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses." Shuedo added the remark, "Thanks for your reply." But thank you. And please sit comfortably. And in a moment, we'll move into our Dharma dialogue. Oh, right.
For a second.
Is there a second mic?
Yeah.
Our 3.5-year-old grandson uses sticks as microphones and pretends he's a rock star. So,
guitar son.
Anyway, so. We'll go between the Zendo here and the Zendo on Zoom, and we teachers will be using a microphone so we can be heard. So we'll start with Ray.
Thank you, David, for your wonderful talk. And I get a strong sense of these spiritual ancestors inviting me to wander, you know, in the mountains. And yet I have these biological ancestors and these human ancestors who sort of, you know, out of my conditioning, my upbringing and so forth, they're present with me also. And they call for loyalty. It's like loyalty to family patterns, you know. They, and so yet, so there's a calling for them to, for me to be a certain way. And then there's the spiritual calling, this other part of me that calls me to rise beyond that. And when I do, I feel the weight of these ancestors to say, no, you know, stay where you are, you know. I guess what I want is some sort of a language to, I try to reassure them, you know, this is good work, and this, I'm doing it for all of you, and, you know. But maybe there's some language to talk with them.
You know, I don't want to give you any language for them. Instead, I want you to look at the situation that arises whenever we oppose two things, when one thing opposes another thing. So there's the physical ancestors, the genetic ancestors, the family ancestors. And then there's these spiritual ancestors who haunt the hills with their beauty and presence. So maybe the work for you is not to find a special language to talk to one over the other, but to see where the overlap is, right? Because all those people, you don't really know them. You know, they're dead in reality, in sort of the Nirmanakaya reality, they're dead. In the other realities, yeah, of course, everything lives forever. There's no past or future. Everything is now. But really, you don't know them. You can't actually have a conversation with them where they respond in any kind of way. You're talking to yourself. So what you have to do is see, you know, I think about my ancestors when you were talking. I loved what you said just now. So they knew stuff that I don't know, and they had a spiritual life that I will never know anything about. And I want to connect into that, and it's there and it's alive. So maybe that's the way to go, not to make up things to say to them, to find the right things, but to do this work of bringing them together, bringing all the ancestors together. Yeah. Thank you.
Pierce.
Are you calling me out of turn here?
No, we go back and forth. We go back and forth.
You're top of my screen. So.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you, David. To wander intentionally, I was really struck by this phrase, and I guess that you know, I want to know that there is something that can direct my steps, even if I'm going in the wrong direction. And you know, I think of the Hongzhi reading as associated with just sitting and just allowing. And yet you pointed out that line about purifying and grinding down and all of that stuff. And so that's in there too. And I especially appreciate your saying, you have a strategy, go ahead, try it, see how that works for you. And it also calls to mind the famous line, which we use a lot from Dogen, mistake after mistake. And it's encouraging in the sense that if I make a mistake, at least I'll know it. If I really, you know, throw myself wholeheartedly into it, mm-hmm. and suddenly find that I'm barking up the wrong tree, at least I'll know it's the wrong tree.
Yeah.
So I especially appreciate this this mm-hmm. phrase, to wander intentionally and make mistakes. Yeah, thank you.
I had a teacher, a ceramics teacher once, and one of her phrases, it's better to be bold and wrong than timid and right. and there is a way, I think our practice calls us forth to boldly go nowhere, as Ray has inscribed on his car, as we all have inscribed on our hearts in some way. But I do want to say that we can get better at wandering, that there is a neural pathway that knows how to trust. And if you watch a little kid, they're not saying, gee, what should I do for the next half hour? It's like this, and then it's this, and then it's this. So all of us know how to wander. We may be a little rusty, so little practice required.
One small thing, Pierce, about the mystery of going out of turn. It's a Zoom thing. that because you're a co-host, you rise to the top of our screen and we can't tell unless we're watching the screen. So we are not watching the screen all the time.
So in the Zendo,
I'm Deb, and I really appreciated the talk and the part about the Katsura tree. So I was wandering in the garden yesterday and came upon the pond, and there's going to be the koi there. Well, there was no koi, and I'm like, okay, there's no koi, they're gone, they're hiding. So kept on walking, and then today I didn't have any ideas about, like, you know, what was going to be there, and came upon the pond again, and surprise, they were hanging out and going. So there was just something about, like, not, you know, having ideas and expectations and knowing what's there, you know. It's just like, yeah, and there was a simple joy of, like, just coming upon the corner.
Alan will respond to that.
Yeah, you know, I love the Zen image of the dragon that rises up, and for me, your koi became a dragon, and it's true, the dragon doesn't arise when we call it. You know, it comes when it wants to, and when it comes, you know, it's so wonderful, and it is flashing and golden like those koi. When it doesn't come, it's really nice to just see the smooth surface of the pond and the lily pads on it.
Thanks,
Madhu. Hi, thank you so much for your talk, David. I really found it very inspiring, and you know, I really appreciate the way you poured your heart and soul into the talk, and you know, and not just your talk, but all three versions of the talk on the koan. I really, really appreciate it, and heartfelt, and you know, I really appreciate the way all teachers, you know, present their original faces in their talks. And I find that very mysterious how that happens. You know, every time, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, it's just so them. And, you know, they are themselves, and they are, you know, they're pouring their hearts and souls. And I just am so fascinated by that. And also your koan, your talk reminded me of the koan that I've lately been, you know, just sitting with, and it's been coming to my head and my mind most frequently. And the koan is, a fire child comes looking for fire. And I mean, this season, this is how I feel. I feel like I'm a fire child who comes again and again looking for that spark, that magic, that fire again and again. And I think your talk reminded me of that. Thank you.
That's beautiful, Madhu. I don't know, everyone that I could see out of the corner of my eye and on screen was smiling as you were talking about Alan and David and me showing our original face, because voila, there is the original face of Madhu, irresistible, full of life and energy. The fire child seeks the fire. That's what a wonderful phrase to carry around. I love that. Yeah.
Thank you.
In
the Zendo. Jenny.
Thank you. I think at least once every session, somebody has to talk about the light in here. And when we were when we had Kinhin this morning, there was just this perfect projection of that window behind the Buddha onto that wall with the hemlock needles and the leaves and everything. And then the next time we went around, it was already gone. And it's just, I don't know. I was just, did somebody line that up? Did somebody put that window there and that tree there and the wall just for that moment? And it feels like it, and I couldn't keep my eyes off the dancing light in front of you. Yeah.
Well, and the teaching is that this is for you, Jenny.
Yeah.
This is all for you.
And I would say, Jenny, that you lined it up.
Yeah. Craig.
Thank you for the talk. The word that caught my mind was pursue. When I think of pursuing, I think of catching. And it's hard not to get attached to the idea that what I pursue, I will catch. Mm. I've spent much of my life as a planner, trying to project what we're going to achieve and measuring our progress against whether we achieved what we imagined. And it's been kind of my koan to think, okay, pursuing is important, but catching maybe not so much. That maybe when I arrive at that destination I imagined, I'll find something, but maybe not what I thought I would find.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, is that, you know, because we've been living with this koan ourselves, there is a catching that's part of this koan. There really is. Some commentators talk about how Changsha is talking about birth and death. And I think about a fetus, you know, summoning up the energy. I don't know how that happens, to force its way either out of the womb somehow or other, you know, either through a cut or through an opening in the woman's body, some kind of opening. It's, how does it happen? It's really amazing. And so the commentators talk about, that's what he's doing. He's wandering, but it's he's wandering into life, right? So the catching is life. He made it. And then when it turns over, when he goes back following the falling flowers, he's moving towards death. And we all do that too. So in a sense, you could say, we've already moved to birth. We've caught birth, and now we're moving towards catching death. So you don't even have to dismiss the catching. I appreciate what you're saying about being free of the concept of having to achieve something, but also something is happening. David pointed that out in the talk there, and just now, there really is a movement towards something mysterious. So if you catch it and, you know, try to pretend that you understand what it is, if you like catch it in your hand and put it into the box, not so great, very limiting. But if you catch it and open your hand and watch where it goes, that's a very different kind of thing. So catching is still okay. You know, you catch the ball and then you throw it to somebody else. Or you catch, this is fun, the microphone practice. You catch the microphone and then you hold on to it. Somebody reaches out their hand or gets called on. There's a game we're playing of moving towards whatever is here. So your engineering mind is perfect, in my opinion.
Yeah, thanks. Someone here in the Zendo? Brad?
The exchange in the koan seems free of strategizing, as his walk in the mountains is, in contrast to other koans where a student is being tested and so forth. I find it difficult not to strategize, either to get back to my bed for a longer rest period or so that what we would use terms like and things like that, getting ahead of the moment. And I appreciate a koan curriculum. It feels like stepping stones in a way. And I appreciate encouragement talks also. And I guess it's like breathing. And every now and then I get tired and I try to keep my hands moving and the bow pointed, I think, in the right direction. But at times I feel like maybe I'll just put the oars up and coast a little bit. So I'm this morning, I feel more like that than taking a deep breath and leaning into it. So that's all.
Yeah, so my encouragement is to take your hands off the oars and drift. And this is following something. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes our practice requires us and we need to and we want to really, you know, take a big bite, right? Mm-hmm. Get into it. And other times that's exactly wrong. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do is drift, let the bow turn wherever the bow turns, give up, mm-hmm. Hands off the oars. Where are the oars? Where's the boat? I have no clue, right? And then that drifting is the following. No fixed position. And I really appreciate you saying that. And in a sense, what I hear you saying is that coming in and taking the hands off the oars is not like you think it's a good idea, but you don't have many options. You're too tired. Right? I would do my strategy and I would work hard if I could, but I haven't gotten enough sleep. And this is exactly right. Right on target.
Yeah, and as David said that, what came to me is when Pierce raised the lines about grinding down from the citruses, it's like we've been ground down, and the resistances. Yeah. You know, we're not reforming ourselves with that grinding. We're taking away all these obstructions that keep us from going with the current. And the great faith part of Zen is that there is a current. Mm-hmm. And if we give ourselves to it, it will take us in the right place.
And when I was listening to you at the beginning, Brad, I was curious about this strategizing that you perceive among the old teachers. I don't perceive them strategizing at all, really, except in the sense of, you know, having to move from one, having to stand up and sit down and open their mouths and speak. So I'm wondering, I want to encourage you that these folks in the koans are mirrors. And so you're seeing yourself in them. But maybe there's another way that they're being, like maybe their words are not coming from strategizing, mm-hmm. but coming something like what Alan was just pointing to, this great dharma coming through them, mm-hmm. that's only here to ease you, as the Tibetans say. It's all it's for. And what if that was true? And it might have you, you can form a different kind of relationship, very similar to what I said to Ray. We're forming a different relationship with our ancestors of all kinds who are indeed here with us and love us. Let them love us.
Thanks. Lara.
Wandering. Wandering was the one word that I chose. And it was actually quite fraught when I chose it. It sounds a lot sweeter as it's been talked about. but I've been noticing that the choosing of the one word is like a very rich practice for me. It's full of my own judgment of my own, which word and how will I know? And as you know, we are asked for that word, the first one came to me was wondering. And I thought, oh, that one sounds really nice. Like, oh, I'm just wondering. And then I continued with that. And I found myself wandering around my mind, getting very attached to how nice it sounded. And I went right under it to find, oh no, wandering is what's actually happening. Wandering, you know. And then as soon as I said it, I had 1,000 more judgments of myself, like, oh, now I've told everyone I'm just wandering, you know. Now I've let it all be seen. And now I've heard it, you know, many more times and attached many other stories to it, but it's been quite a fun journey to wander around with wandering. So thank you.
You know, Hollinger also says, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. So wander and wonder, they're very close, aren't they? And I think, did maybe Alan bring that up? She sent that up in your talk? No. Did I? Did you? No. Anyway, they are.
It's pointed now.
It's pointed now. And how wonderful, and wonderful also, right? Wonderful, wonderful. When you said that word in the beginning on the first night, I was so excited thinking about our one mind, because we had planned to do this call about wandering, and there you were. And then you were brought right along, holding hands with Changsha in the mountains.
Anyone else here in the Zendo? Yeah, Steve.
Yeah. Thank you for the talk and for everyone, to everyone for the discussion. And this wandering, of course, got me. Also, in this is prayer that I has come to my mind over this sashin, and says, my Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. And to me, it breaks my heart that it's real for me. And, but then there's, I'm thinking of your 3.5-year-old grandson.
Yeah.
I have no idea where I'm going. Why do I need to know where I'm going? But in all this, but just this, that, this need to strategize and to know, and the difficulty in not knowing and trusting. And this is very healing for me, this notion it could be, I have no idea where I'm going. And it's very, it's not an awful thing.
Yeah. Well, and I love that, Steve, just your physical body, right? And the original face is revealed once more. Of course, there's no place to hide. And I think one of the wonderful things about these Dharma dialogues and about having different teachers is you can see the true form of the Dharma, right? When each person talks, the true form of the Dharma is not sitting somewhere else other than in your seat. Right, and much harder to see in ourselves often than in other people. But anyway, appreciating that I have no idea. And in some ways, it almost what we are most afraid of is the point of where we find liberation, right? Whatever you are most afraid of, if this happens, I'll be lost. If I don't know, if I don't have a plan, if I can't solve this, but this place of failure, both a heartache and to acknowledge that depth, like, oh, I wanted to be the guy who knew, right? I really wanted to be that guy. And that guy has to die, right? And it's so sad and such a relief. Right. Then you are 3.5 and the world is just what the world is, no separation. Yeah. Thanks, Steve.
Just a reality check on our grandson. Two things. In case you think, wow, the grandson of Zen masters, he must be so amazing. He's just, you know, wandering around having this perfect life. I was just reading an article in the New Yorker before we started. I haven't finished it, about identity, who we know, who we are. And he begins by saying he has a four-year-old, and he looks at the four-year-old and he tries to remember being four. He can't remember at all. And he looks at his four-year-old and thinks, what will you remember? He remembers, you know, the feeling of his grandmother's lap, or he remembers what his father's face looked like. I was reading it going, right, this whole life is happening and nobody's going to remember it. little bits and pieces. The other thing is, that he has learned to have associative thinking. And he knows when Nana and Baba are coming, and he knows Baba brings his computer, and he has this plan. Whenever Baba brings the computer, they're going to write on the computer. It always happens. It's very exciting. And we have another friend who babysits who comes to see him and she says, so I brought a list of what we can do today. What would you like to do? So he's already learning the picking and choosing part. It doesn't seem like a negative thing. It doesn't even seem like a negative thing that he's not going to remember any of this. But I think he'll remember the essence nature of being loved, of being in company with people who see him, you know, who see what you were just pointing out. You know, you touched all our hearts, Steve. There is something beyond we don't go off wandering in the mountains to take photographs and put them in our album, and, right? Luckily, Changsha didn't have an iPhone, not that I know of, but you know. So there's this, some quality happens when we release ourselves from having to know everything. And I think that's where we're kind of circling around. So but I don't want you to idealize are the perfect grandson, although to us he is, as I'm sure all your grandchildren and children are, and your parents and sisters and brothers, maybe.
Anyone else in the Zoom Zendo? Okay, here. So wonderful place to stop. We'll come back into our Zazen posture.